Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 109, More Disasters. The Fort William Henry massacre was just the latest disaster that the British had to face in the Seven Years' War. But as we discussed in the end of our last episode, it could have been so much worse. A lack of supplies forced Montcalm to withdraw, even though the path through to Fort Edward and the Hudson was open. This was, though, after all, just one small part of the frontier. So we'll begin today by looking at what else was going on. In the far south, things were going, perhaps not well, but certainly not bad. The British were advancing further into the backcountry and established Fort Loudoun in what would later become Tennessee. This was coupled with Fort Prince George, 100 miles to the southeast. The importance of this was that it enabled further trade between the British settlements in South Carolina and the Cherokee, whom the British were hoping to form an alliance with. Further north, 1757 continued in much the same manner as 1756, a series of raids emanating from Fort Duquesne. Maryland continued to do little. Meanwhile, in Virginia, Washington and the other Virginian officers were becoming increasingly dissatisfied with the House of Burgesses, specifically with how stingy they were with pay. They grew so fed up that Washington travelled north to Philadelphia to meet with Loudoun, and request that the Virginia regiment be brought into the regular army, with royal commissions. Washington made the case that his troops were well trained and had served for 3 years. He finished off his request with, quote, "We are very certain that no body of regular troops ever before served 3 bloody campaigns without attracting royal notice," end quote. Loudoun did not give Washington a royal commission, and instead stationed a regular regiment in Pennsylvania, with Washington reporting to its colonel, John Stanwix, but having full control of Virginia's defence. On the one hand, this indicated that Loudoun trusted Washington and his men, giving his force the task of defending Virginia. However, the force in Pennsylvania immediately began requesting supplies from Washington, placing Washington under yet more strain. This was combined with Loudoun moving 200 of Washington's troops to Charleston in South Carolina to prevent a potential slave uprising, replacing the Highland Regiment, who were moved to the colony's frontier to prevent an invasion that never happened. This left Washington with between 400 and 700 men to hold a chain of 18 forts across the frontier. As Game of Thrones readers will know, not even the fictional Night's Watch was able to do this. Their 1,000 men were not able to hold the 17 forts of the 300-mile wall, and they had the benefit of being fictional. Washington followed the same strategy and abandoned most of his forts, deciding to abandon 11 of the 18 forts. Without the benefits of a 700-foot-high magical wall, this had the predictable result of allowing the French and Indians to raid as they wished. Washington complained bitterly to Dinwiddie in October. The campaign had been a disaster, and Washington wrote that a repeat of the year would destroy the colony. They needed to launch an offensive campaign to take out Fort Duquesne. The French Governor-General, Vaudreuil, wrote, quote, "All parties have carried terror among our enemies to a point that the settlements of the English in Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia are abandoned. All the settlers have retreated to the city or into the forest." End quote. He wasn't wrong. Pennsylvania was slightly more promising for the British, but not for military reasons. You'll recall that in 1756 the Quakers had left politics and they'd made diplomatic overtures to the Eastern Delawares, which, when combined with official Pennsylvanian diplomacy and conflicting interests of the Penn family and the campaign, led to a rather complicated situation, which was further confused by the involvement of the Iroquois and issues going back to the Walking Purchase. This had been rumbling on in the background of our narrative since the middle of 1756, and I haven't wanted to get into it. But I really want to quote a paragraph of Anderson's Crucible of War for its glorious complexity. Quote, "Governor Denny was there to represent the province of Pennsylvania, and of course the interests of the Penn family. But William Denny was also his own man, and shrewdly capable of seeming, in the morning, to be for the proprietaries, at noon, of no party, and at night, plump for the assembly. At Easton, he was acting most of all as a direct subordinate of the Earl of Loudoun, and as a career officer in the British Army. He aimed, therefore, at obtaining a strategic peace with the Eastern Delawares. If, in doing so, it was necessary to expose and renounce a 20-year-old land fraud, that was merely unfortunate for the proprietors. His oath was to the king, not the Penns, and the interest of the king in restoring peace with the Indians and gaining them as allies against the French far superseded any obligation he had to protect the pecuniary interests of the proprietors. Denny was not, however, the only delegate from Pennsylvania at the conference. Four commissioners representing the assembly attended, vigilant to protect their constituents' interests against the powers of the proprietors. Agents of the Penn family were there too, intending to preserve the Walking Purchase, thwart the massive secession of Wyoming lands to the Delawares, and make sure that Denny did not respond too eagerly to the advice of the Assembly's commissioners. Observers from the Iroquois Confederacy were also on hand, chiefs who were as reluctant as the Penns to see the Walking Purchase renounced, and by no means pleased to see Tidashakung, the Delaware chief, who was supposed to be taking orders from them, negotiating his own people's settlement with the government of Pennsylvania. To complicate matters further, George Croghan was at Easton as the deputy of Sir William Johnson, charged with preserving Johnson's status as the sole crown authority, authorized to negotiate with the Northern Indians. Yet Croghan was also on the lookout, as always, for opportunities to promote his own interests as a private trader and land speculator. And of course, Pemberton and his colleagues from the Friendly Association, for regaining and preserving peace with the Indians by pacific measures, were also in attendance, acting as ostensibly neutral observers, but, insofar as they advised the Indians and kept an independent record of the proceedings, as de facto allies of Tidashakung and the Delawares. Yet, even the Quakers' presence was complicated, and perhaps compromised, by the fact that Pemberton had been cultivating closer relations with Colonel Stanwix, Loudoun's deputy, who supported a peace settlement in order to gain Eastern Delaware allies for a campaign in the Ohio Valley, not to realise the Quakers' hopes of bringing a prompt, diplomatic end to the bloodshed. End quote. That's only scratching the surface of what is a truly fascinating incident, but I hope that short excerpt gives you a sense of what was going on. Anyway, the conference was, perhaps surprisingly, remarkably successful, as everyone worked with what they needed, what they wanted, and what they could live with. The Delawares wanted to have the Walking Purchase revoked. The representatives of the Penn family wanted to keep it, but both could live with it being examined. Croghan would be happy if this examination was done by William Johnson. The Delawares could live with an examination of the purchase if the British brought about immediate aid to their settlements in the Wyoming Valley, which the British would be happy to do in exchange for an alliance. The Iroquois could live with this deal if it were done under their formal aegis. This wasn't a diplomatic revolution, but it was a significant moment. It neutralised the Eastern Delawares and brought about a compromise that had seemed impossible weeks earlier. while it did nothing about the French alliance with the Western Delawares, it was an opening that could be worked. Now, let's talk about the one thing we still have to cover. Loudon, who we last left sailing out of New York, worrying about the defences he had left behind. He arrived at Halifax, Nova Scotia, on June 30th, and he was joined by a Royal Navy squadron on July 9th, but the French were reinforcing their own fleet at Louisbourg, and were much stronger. Loudon wanted to advance, but Admiral Holbourne wouldn't move until he knew what the size of the French fleet was, and they couldn't do that until bad weather and fog cleared, which didn't happen until the beginning of August. Loudon wanted to know what they could do, and Holbourne reported that bearing in mind the strength of the French and the time of year, there was no hope of a successful assault, so Loudon promptly returned to New York. Considering what had happened to Admiral Byng after the incident in Minorca, it was a bold decision, but a wise one. This was particularly obvious as, after escorting Loudon back to New York, Holbourne's force was hit by a hurricane in September and was nearly smashed to pieces, although they were still heavily damaged. Upon his return to New York, Loudon had time to process the disaster of Fort William Henry and began to work out a plan. Much like Washington, he concluded that it was necessary for the British to take the offensive. There was no time to repair Fort William Henry, so Loudon intended to wait until the first frost of the year and then march from Fort Edward directly to Lake George and move light cannon over the ice to attack Fort Carillon. Had the frost not been so late, arriving in February, and so heavy, there was 3 feet of snow, it could well have worked. Instead, Loudon spent the winter dealing with administrative tasks with the governors of the northern colonies as he struggled to attract recruits. Loudon worked on planning campaigns for the next summer, but he found it increasingly difficult to do anything with the governors. He was thoroughly drained, and would have been very pleased to know that Pitt had decided to replace him. Indeed, back in London, Pitt was changing his whole approach to the war. But that will have to wait until next time. Thanks for listening, I'll see you then.